Who was Adolf Hitler? A half century later, we ask the question again.
Oh, God. Oh.
I wanted to say that when I first set out to write the book on Adolf Hitler, and I made the acquaintance of all his private staff, the four secretaries, Christian Schröder, Johanna Wolf, Gerda Danowski, and Traudl Junger, who died a couple of years ago. And I met also the adjutants who had served with him, and the generals, the field marshals, Sivazev. When you, like all Germans, even now, you find that they had two faces, or two opinions. There was the opinion they were prepared to show to strangers, and the private opinion they would reveal to you, they would disclose to you once you had won their trust. And all of these people on Adolf Hitler's private staff, they stunned me by showing great admiration for him and speaking of him only in the most glowing and positive terms. And these were educated people. They'd been to staff college, they'd been to university. They weren't just trailer trash. These were people with great insight and perception, and they'd known him for the last 10 or 12 years of his life, and they spoke well of him, even in the 1960s and 1970s. And that's what convinced me that he was worth investigating in depth, doing a real job on.
In 1989, I was making a World Service documentary about Adolf Hitler for the centenary of his birth. One of the people I spoke to was his former secretary, Traudl Junger, who was still working for him at the time of his death.
I came to work for Hitler actually by chance. I was a 22-year-old girl and I wanted to go away from home. And as my sister was in Berlin working as a dancer, I was so longing to go to Berlin too that I took a chance to get a job in the Reichskanzlei, in the Reichschancellery, as a secretary, as a typist. And one day, Hitler was in his headquarters in East Prussia. He needed a younger secretary because one of his secretaries had married. And 10 girls were sent to his headquarters, and Hitler chose me. And on January the 1st of 1943, I was officially engaged, employed by him.
To begin with, Traudl Junger only had to deal with Hitler's personal letters, fan mail from German citizens, and even love letters from obsessed women. She had to send out congratulations to mothers who'd just had their sixth child to tell them Hitler had become that baby's godfather.
When I came, it was already 1943. The war was at its deepest point, actually, after Stalingrad. And the secretaries hadn't to do much work for Hitler anymore, but we got another duty. We were asked to have the meals with Hitler so he could relax in the conversation with girls who were not interested in politics and all those things. And he could have a very simple and actually trivial conversation to relax from his duties.
What was he like as a man?
The secretaries, at least, found him a very friendly, charming, polite and patient chief. He has even a sense of humor, and we never experienced any loud words or something unfriendly. And to me, as I was the youngest, he had actually more or less a fatherly behavior. I liked him, and I felt well in his company. And I enjoyed talking to him and listen to his more or less monologues.
And Hitler's monologues, it seems, were something that Paul Junger, like most Germans, agreed with. After all, to them he was a saviour after the humiliation and defeat of the First World War and the economic collapse that had followed.
Everybody was in a very bad economic situation. There was unemployment, there was hunger and inflation. And then Hitler came and offered that he would make Germany as a great nation again, and he would give back our lost self-confidence. And I myself, I was educated that my home country was something I have to serve to, and I was Vaterlandsliebe, and I was very proud of my country, actually. I was infected, actually, by the singing and the crying and shouting to greet him, and I felt it was something very touching. And after he came to power, he started immediately to put in practice what he promised, and he gave housing to the workers and employment to the unemployed, and there was food, and everything was in order again.
Sie Kontakt zu den Nationalsozialisten damals?
Ja, als ich das Blaue Licht bewusst ich von deren Existenz überhaupt nichts, habe ich nicht mal den Namen Hitler gekannt. Wie Sie meinen, während der Zeit, wo ich am Blauen Licht kam, da habe ich keine Ahnung gehabt. Überhaupt nicht.
Und als Sie dann der Filmjournalist Ernst Jäger in einem Gespräch auf Hitler aufmerksam gemacht hat?
Da sagte er mir, gehen Sie heute in diese Versammlung der Nationalsozialisten. Das habe ich gar nicht verstanden. Ich sage, wieso? Ich war noch... Was soll das? Ja, da ist doch, heute spricht doch Hitler in Berlin, im Sportpalast. Ja und, sagte ich, sagte, wissen Sie, ich habe so das Gefühl, wenn Sie ihn hören würden, das könnte Ihr Schicksal werden. Habe ich gelacht, sag ich, wieso soll das mein Schicksal werden? Sagte der Jäger, der also ein Gegner der Nationalsozialisten war, was ich aber nicht wusste, hatte keine Ahnung. Ja, sagt er, das würde ich Ihnen doch raten. Und da wurde ich neugierig und bin hingegangen. Und das war eben mein Schicksal. Ja.
Ich weiß es, meine Kameraden, es ist euch wohl oft schwer gefallen, wenn ihr meintet, es müsse und unentwandelt kommen. Und er kann nicht und immer wieder muss er euch da fehlgerichtet werden. Es muss weiter gekämpft werden. Es geht nicht. Ihr dürft nicht handeln. Ihr müsst gehorchen. Ihr müsst euch fügen. Ihr müsst euch diesen unharten Zwang beugen.
Es war eben so, ich habe das erste Mal in meinem Leben eine politische Versammlung gesehen. Es war für mich ungeheuer beeindruckend. Ich wurde mitgerissen von der ganzen Stimmung und ich hatte damals von Hitler einen faszinierenden Eindruck. Und daraufhin, aufgrund dieses Eindrucks, habe ich ihm einen Brief geschrieben und wollte ihn kennenlernen, weil ich mir dachte, na, ist das vielleicht der Mann, der Deutschland retten kann? mir sagte der Adjutant, als ich ihn fragte, wieso habe ich eine Antwort bekommen, sagte mir der Herr Brückner, ja, der Führer war begeistert von ihrem Tanz an das Meer im Heiligen Berg. Das hat ihm so gefallen.
Hatten Sie dann, als Sie persönlich mit ihm zusammen waren?
Ja, interessant. Er war das Gegenteil von dem Eindruck, den ich im Sportpalast hatte. Im Sportpalast wirkte er wie ein Politiker, der also die Leute begeistert oder versucht zu begeistern. Und dort wirkte er eigentlich wie ein ganz bescheidener Privatmann, von dem man gar nicht sich vorstellen konnte, dass der Massen bewegen konnte. Er wirkte sehr natürlich, sehr einfach und bescheiden. Also machte einen sympathischen Eindruck. Als ich ihn das erste Mal auf Plakaten sah, fand ich ihn ausgesprochen hässlich. Aber als ich ihn dann im Leben traf, ihm gegenüber, war das verschwunden. Da hat man diese Züge oder diesen Schnurrbart und so gar nicht wahrgenommen. Da ging eine sehr große Ausstrahlung von ihm aus und da war das nicht mehr so der Fall. Aber als Mann hat er mich überhaupt nicht interessiert und fasziniert.
Einmal merke ich, dass der Blick von Hitler auf mir ruht. Und da schaue ich auf, tatsächlich, er schaut mich so an. Und das war einer der seltsamsten Momente meines Lebens. Ich habe das Gefühl gehabt, er sucht irgendwie, der Blick, der zunächst ganz auf mich gerichtet war, ging auf einmal durch mich hindurch, in eine unbekannte Ferne. Das ist so sonderbar gewesen. Und der lange Blick, den er mir geschenkt hat, hat mich vollkommen überzeugt, dass er ein Mann mit ehrlichen Absichten war. Ich kann nur eins sagen, ich bin glücklich, dass mir Hitler von seiner schönsten Seite begegnet ist. Es hat sicher auch dunkle Seiten gegeben, aber ich habe ihn von seiner wunderbaren Seite erlebt. Und das ist etwas, was mir kein Mensch nehmen kann.
I had the occasion to talk to him without any other company. And I told him we will have the opportunity to attack London, and London is covered by fog, and we can fly with everything we have available, even with the Junkers 52, like we did in Warsaw. And he said, stop it, stop it. I don't want to hear this. The whole attack on England is against my opinion, against my willing. I could stop it. The English population is of such high class and they are so similar to the Germans. And I hate to fight them.
One day, an officer from the German Navy headquarters in Berlin arrived at our base in Kiel with the order to make available one man for Adolf Hitler's personal service. And he should be one of the experienced sailors, and not just one of those who were on land duty, but rather one who had actually served at sea. The reason for this was that Adolf Hitler, on one occasion, had traveled from Berlin to Dresden to attend an opera. Hitler then realized that he didn't have a dress shirt with him. And so someone had to quickly drive him around to find a new shirt. Goering then suggested to him that he find a manservant who would be solely responsible for his personal belongings, and that it would be best that he take someone from the Navy, as they were the most experienced and versatile men. Goering told Hitler that he himself had such a manservant from the Navy, and that he was very pleased with him. I was only asked, would you be interested? But really, in the military, you just do your duty and you go where you're sent. Three of us were selected, and we were sent to see General Blomberg. He then took us to meet with Adolf Hitler, and he introduced us. There was one other sailor who had just come into Berlin. I myself had just come in from the Baltic, and another came in from the North Sea. We had to wait there in Berlin for 2 days. Eventually, we were all introduced to Hitler, and then we went up separately to his office for interviews. Finally, it was my turn. I introduced myself, and I was asked a few basic things like, who are you? Do you know why you're here? Do you know what we're looking for? It was all quite routine, and then we were dismissed. Herr Bruckner, who was there, gave each of us 50 marks and told us to go out and see Berlin and then to report back the next day. We stayed overnight in the barracks at Lichterfelde with Hitler's personal SS regiment. And then we went back the next day, but nothing had been decided yet. Well, 2 days later, I was informed the Führer has decided that he'll take you. They said, Herr Krause, you can now go and collect your personal effects from the base and then report back here. So I went up to Kiel to get my things and then came back to the Reichschancellery. When I arrived, Hitler gave me his hand and he greeted me warmly, saying, so, you've come to be in my service. And we went outside into the garden. I went to fetch a couple of chairs for us, but he said, oh, no, no, that'll be your job in the future. Today, please allow me. And so he then brought over 2 chairs for us. There were several other people there at the time. Dr. Goebbels, his wife and family, several other ladies, but I don't remember who they all were now. Anyways, he and I went off about 20 or 30 meters away from all of the others. We sat down across from one another in the garden, and we had a short conversation. He asked me about my family, where I come from, what my father does, and things like that. We spoke for a little while, I guess maybe 10 minutes or so. Then we got up, brought the chairs back to the table, and then I left. Now I only had my Navy uniform with me, so Herr Bruckner arranged for me to go see a tailor who made 2 suits for me, one dark and one white. I was then sent to a hospitality trade school located in Munich because I really had no idea what all of my duties were going to be, particularly with his clothing and so on. And so there, I received some professional training. It was actually during the summer holidays, so there was no one else there. And so I received one-on-one training with the instructors there. I would spend an hour or so with one here, then an hour with somebody else, and so on. The director of the school, Herr Kermes, would drive me around Munich, and we would go to various establishments where we would be served. Herr Kermes would then point out to me all of the various mistakes that the waiters were making. And he would say to me, you have to do it like this, or from this side, or the other side, when serving dinner or drinks, and so on and so forth. And then one day, I was finally called to report to the Führer. Even though I had not quite finished my training yet, I was first put to work at Buckenberg at the Harvest Festival. And there I thought, well, I'll just stay in the background for now. But he took me by the arm and showed me where he wanted me to be. And he said, this is your place over here. Then he told me, you're also responsible for my security. That didn't really bother me. I suppose I was a bit nervous inwardly, in the way that one gets nervous in any new situation. But as a soldier, basically I thought, it's no big deal. And I thought to myself, well, whatever happens, happens. Basically, I just learned my job on the fly. Later on, when we went to Obersalzberg, it was obvious that I couldn't be there in civilian dress, but I didn't have the right uniform either. My Navy uniform was way out of place up there, so an SS uniform was needed. We went to town in the morning and had one made up and picked it up in the evening. They had it ready the very same day, but they didn't have any black SS boots for me. So they gave me a pair of brown SA boots and had to dye them black for me later. There's still some pictures around from those early days. I think I looked pretty silly. Now, at first I worked alone, but later it became too much for me. I was working from very early in the morning until quite late at night. I didn't get to bed sometimes until 1 or 1:30 in the morning. And for me, that was just too much. Later on, at Obersalzberg, I had to serve his visitors too, and it just became way too much for me. So then, three more men were brought in to assist me. Well, first two, then later another two. But one of them didn't last very long, and he was sent back. He really wasn't happy there, and he just couldn't do it. So that left the three of us. There was Herr Meyer, and of course Herr Linge, who was also with Hitler right up until the very end in Berlin. As for Herr Meyer, however, he returned to his unit, as he had requested, and he was killed in action during the war. Hitler said then, "There are only Germans and no party." He really said that. It was in the city of Bayreuth when we were with Winifred Wagner, and I was perhaps just 2 or 3 meters away when he said it. Well, of course, get up in the morning and have everything ready. I'd have a uniform hanging for him there. We had one of those things which Professor Toad had designed. Oh, what's it called again? Sort of a stand over which he would hang his jacket or anything that was new. He would let himself in and out of his room, and he undressed by himself in private into a shirt. He wore a nightshirt, not pajamas. I would make his bed, and the maids would clean everything. And then I would bring him his breakfast. It was already prepared downstairs. I would just bring it up to him and carry it in. I had to fetch it from downstairs because his quarters were on the upper floor in the Reichschancellery. And so there he ate his breakfast. And that consisted of a chocolate bar, some Leibniz cookies, and 2 glasses of warm milk. And I had this thing to keep things warm with, you know. The milk was in a container that would hold about 2 or 2.5 cups. And he ate the Leibniz cookies and some chocolate. He would eat this every day for breakfast? Yes, every morning. Whether in Berlin or Obersalzberg or in Munich, it was the same everywhere. The breakfast was always the same. Leibniz cookies and chocolate. Did he always eat breakfast alone, or were others present? There was no one there. No one. Not even at Obersalzberg or wherever. Not even Eva Braun was there. Never. Me? No, I'm not a vegetarian. But yes, Hitler was. Up until the start of the war, however, he began to eat some sardines. Not so much because he enjoyed them, but because of the fish oil. Perhaps his doctors, Morell or Brandt, had recommended them to him. But otherwise, he was a strict vegetarian. Even when we were entertaining guests, there were vegetarian dishes prepared. But afterwards, they would all sneak into the kitchen and they would break out the schnitzel. Everyone could eat what they wanted. Even he himself. You know, the kitchen staff would make up a menu of 3 or 4 choices. And I would take these to him when he was having his breakfast, so he could choose what he wanted to eat later on. This, this, or that. And then he would say, "Okay, I'll have this," or "I'll have that." And I would go to the chef, especially there in Berlin, and I'd tell them, today the boss, as I said earlier, we called him the boss would like to eat this or that today. And I would be served, whether in Berlin or at Obersalzberg. I would be served my meals separately, while the guests would be served by the staff waiters. Now that was one of the nicest times, when we were at Obersalzberg. Okay, maybe not from the very beginning, because there were so many visitors. Every time, well, actually this one time, one of the ladies who was visiting, they were having coffee together. And I really don't know all of the details. It was really only something I had heard, that one of them had said to Hitler that he ought to get married. And that really made him mad. And so after that, no more women up there. But we had a wonderful time there on Obersalzberg. No women, no stress. It took over a year before he ever said again that anything was wrong. You know, he wasn't snooping around everywhere. The everyday things didn't bother him. Okay, so you couldn't describe him as ungrateful? Never. How was his behavior then? Can you describe him? He was very normal, and like every other person. Only when there were foreigners or guests present, then he was very meticulous. You know what I mean, right? Meticulous. I mean, he was a bit, well, correct? Well, that's not really the word either. What can I say then? Just meticulous. When this bothered him or that bothered him, when the little things weren't in order, that was just not acceptable. He'd usually sleep until noon, and then he would eat lunch, sometimes without eating his breakfast, and then we would go for a nice walk. Usually, we'd walk down to some of the nearby villages and have a cup of coffee. Or once in a while, though not very often, we'd drive up to the Eagle's Nest, the tea house, but very seldom. And why is that? I really don't know. You said that you would often go for walks together. Yes, and mostly alone, but not always. I'd usually walk a few meters behind him and any others that were there, so I didn't always know what they were discussing. There were others that would go along. There was sometimes another bodyguard for his safety. There were three men from the police. And we would go up to Hochlenzer, sometimes down to Scharskale. On two occasions, we walked all the way to Königssee. Sometimes Mr. Blomberg would come along too, and this one time, everyone else had to stay behind when Blomberg was there. So there was the three of us, Herr Hitler, Blomberg, and myself. We didn't want to stand out too much. And we went into the guest lodge called Schiffmeister and had a cup of coffee, just the three of us. Then later, we were joined by the bodyguard and various other guests that had been invited. And nobody even noticed us. It was only when all of the others had joined us that the people became aware of our presence. And then there would be 50 or 100 people standing around, and they would cry that they wanted to see their Führer. And then later, the chauffeurs would come with the cars to pick us up and take us back to Obersalzberg. And so you would just simply walk on into these guest lodges? Yes, right on in, without any notice. Nobody knew that we were coming. But Hitler, he had no fear. He was undemanding. It was really only when foreigners, ladies, or dignitaries were present that he expected that the proper etiquette be maintained. But otherwise, he was easy to please. What were his personal expectations? None. What he did, or what he had built, he did for his people, not for himself. He was an uncomplicated man, that's clear. When others, or how shall I say it, important personalities were present, then he would become almost fearful, not regarding himself, but rather that things could go wrong. It was just his concern that things might not turn out as planned, and he could become worried, almost afraid. His mission was to raise the German people up to the highest level. That was his idea. He wanted things to finally go well for the Germans. In terms of his personal possessions, he had a big iron bed, a closet for clothes, and another for shoes, and that was about it. The one thing I could never really understand is that he would use two razor blades every time that he would shave. Well, for me, that's a bit extreme. A razor cuts better the second time than the first. So that's the sort of thing where I had to wonder a little bit and ask, you know, what for, really? But he was really a simple man. The simplest man there ever was. Again, when there were important people, ladies, film stars, etc. present, then he insisted upon etiquette. Then nothing dared go wrong. When we got into the car, and he would sit down, and he would be wearing his long overcoat, I would grab his collar from behind him, and I would pull him up, and then he could settle himself in. And he would say sometimes along the way, "Remember this when you write your memoirs, how you would grab me by the collar and pull me up." And with that, I just want to demonstrate how simple he was to deal with. One time he said to me, and this was in the early days, "Herr Krause, when are you ever going to go out?" And I said, "Well, when the Führer goes to bed." "Oh," he said with a laugh, "well, then I'll have to ring for a very long time." You see, there was this box, and this thing would drop down to notify me when the Führer had rang. "Well," he said, "just remember then, when you go out, that there are two types of women." And then he stopped and said, "Oh, wait a minute, you're a Navy man." And he put his finger to his head like this and he said, "You're an experienced sailor, so you would know all the tricks." And with that, again, I just want to demonstrate how easygoing he was with things. He loved children, that's clear. That could never be feigned. Even the historians acknowledge that much. It was not feigned. His main concern was, he wanted to ensure that nothing would ever befall his people again. He took it upon himself and he said, "Never again." Earlier, in the First World War, he was a message carrier. And so he had to run across the front lines, often through a hail of bullets. And you have to realize that, in those situations, one totally loses touch with the feeling of fear. If anyone had wanted to, it would have been easy to assassinate him. But when something was really bothering him, he became quiet. And he would spend many hours alone, just gone, until he had, in some way, come to terms with the issue that was on his mind. He would spend a lot of time reading. Every week, he would read every illustrated magazine that was available in Germany, or at very least, flip through them. I would also buy books for him. Anytime I saw a new book that I thought would be of interest to him, I would buy it and give it to him. And this one time, he really amazed me. It was evening, and there were perhaps 12 or 15 people at the table having dinner. And he started to talk about this new book he had been reading. And he said, I've read this book, and it says that. And I thought to myself, that's impossible. I just gave him that book yesterday. He could not have finished reading that book already. And then he said to me, please go up and get the book for me. It's on my nightstand. So I bring it down, and he says to open it to a certain page number and to read it. And so I opened it and began to read it aloud. And then I thought to myself, he could not have read this book in a single night. It would have taken me a few full days to read it. And he didn't even spend all night with it. I was just dumbfounded. How on earth did he do that? I mean, he had so many other things on his mind to deal with. But he had already memorized many things from this same book. I was just stunned. I was really amazed too when we would get on board a plane, how he would notice right away if one of the engines wasn't running exactly the same as the others. And he would say to me, please go ask them about it. Other times when we were out riding in the car, if a spark plug might be misfiring, he sensed it at once. There was this one time at Christmas. We wrapped a bunch of presents for all of his special friends. Something for this one, for that one, and the other one. And at the end he said, now please order us a taxi. I was floored. He said, you don't need to change, just put on an overcoat. I thought, what's going on? I said to him, but the chauffeur is downstairs. And he said, oh, no, he can take the car and go home now. So we just got into the cab and drove off from the rear exit, which was used for deliveries and such. He took his keys and he locked up behind us. I thought, well, I should probably sit up front next to the driver. But he took my arm and pulled me to the rear door. So then I got in the back with him. Then he started telling the driver, go here, go there, go there, go here. I think the driver thought to himself, well, here's a couple of strange ones. Then suddenly he told the driver, go to Café Luitpold. I thought to myself, oh my goodness, here I am alone with him and we're going to Café Luitpold? It's probably closing time over there. The driver, well, I was to pay him with a 50 mark note. And I did expect to get some change back. But Hitler said no, let him keep it. I think I had not quite closed the door, and the taxi took off quickly. The door slammed shut, and he was gone. He was probably thinking, thank God I'm rid of them. And then we went for a walk to Marienplatz. As per usual, I started to walk a meter or so behind him, like I always do. But he said, no, come here on my side. Nobody will believe that I'm actually walking around here in Munich. It was around 11 or 11:30 at night. Whenever someone would approach us from the opposite direction, he just grabbed his hat and pulled it down a bit and kept his head tilted forward so that no one would recognize him. It was very icy, so we locked arms just to support ourselves because it was terribly slippery. Then finally, we came to Polsientenplatz, where his apartment was. When suddenly we heard, halt! There was police across the way patrolling. And there was one of his guards in the doorway from the Waffen-SS. And a couple of police officers patrolling up and down the street. And we were about to cross the street. And one calls out, halt! Verboten! So Hitler stopped and waited, and I went ahead and approached them. As the man recognized me, he firmly clicked his heels together and saluted. I remember it well, even now. And then we went ahead and continued on inside the apartment. But once inside, I received some harsh words from Himmler and the others. because I hadn't reported in that I was going out alone with him in the city. But Hitler, he was never scared. He just wanted to go out and see old Munich again, alone, without being bothered, without anyone following him around. He just wanted to go alone. He would look around here and there, in this window or that one, just to see what's going on, and to see some of his favorite places again, from the old days. And he was never scared. Even in Poland, when we visited the front lines, we went to inspect some of the graves there, and he would walk around openly, with me following him as usual. Keitel and the others were just beside themselves. I mean, we were not more than 100 meters away from the front line during the war in Poland. Well, what can I say? I didn't like her, and she didn't like me either. Why not? Well, put it this way. Most people would say to her, "Dear lady," "gracious lady," and things like that. And I just couldn't bring myself to say it. I mean, gracious? Who's gracious? God only, perhaps. And she took it as an insult, I suppose. At first she was there more or less on her own. But later, Frau Brandt or Frau Morell would come by, or Frau Bormann, although she was there less often. And later there would be film stars who were invited too. And so she was more or less always with them. Otherwise, we had a fairly normal, cordial, friendly relationship. As to how she and Hitler were together, privately, well, the door was locked and I never went in, so I couldn't say. That was overwhelming, and there was no use of force. We just headed straight down there that day, and nobody knew we were coming. It was only when we got to the border that it became widely known that Hitler was in Austria and was en route to Vienna, and the word spread fast, faster perhaps than by radio or TV. And how did the people react? Oh my goodness. They were screaming, this high-pitched screaming. At dinner, I was exhausted, and I fell asleep. I could still only hear this screaming in my ears. They were so excited. My duties there were primarily for security. But honestly, I hardly saw him, even though he was right in front of me. I saw nothing. I was just looking into the crowd to see what was going on. Hitler said, "My fellow Austrians, now I have brought you into the Reich." And he was totally excited. He was happy, joyful, and just thrilled that everything went so smoothly. We rented the entire hotel there where we stayed, and there was this little episode. The bill came, and I don't recall how big it was now. And Hitler had given me some money to pay for various things, but Herr Bruckner paid for most of it. Bruckner said, "The bill is way too high." Hitler said, Maybe they've got many debts too. Just pay it. It was the night with the synagogues. I remember it very well, as they were set ablaze, back then on the 9th of November. Herr Schaup came in and he said, "The synagogues are burning all over Germany." Hitler knew absolutely nothing about it. He suddenly became pale as a ghost, and he said, "What the hell have they done? I will get the blame for this." That was his expression, truly from him, his words directly. Herr Schaup began to say something, and Dr. Goebbels too. "I don't care," said Hitler. And he got up, and we all went out, got into the car, and drove through Munich. And then we sat there in the car, nearby where one of the synagogues was on fire. Then we went into his apartment on Prinzregentenstrasse. I let them in and locked up. And then I was dismissed. But he opened the door one more time to say that he wanted to be woken up early in the morning at a certain time. He was totally outraged about the situation. Totally incensed. I'll repeat it. He said, "What have they done? I will be blamed for this." Herr Schaup remembered it that way as well, and Dr. Goebbels too. What more can I say? We jumped in the car, nothing was said. We drove around Munich and we looked around. In that area, not far from where he lived, though just briefly. Then we went to his place, we went to his room, and I was dismissed until it was time to wake him in the morning. He raised his hand and he slapped it down on his knee and he said, "It's done. Really. It's done." That they had come to an understanding, and with it, he had achieved security that would cover Germany's back. The generals had all gathered there on that day, and Hitler waited until each had departed, going out their own way, some through the front, some through the garden, the same way that they had arrived together. He sat there, not far from me, at the window, about as far away as that window there, and I stood nearby. He said, "No one comes through here now," because there was another entrance nearby from the kitchen. And he sat there in his chair and was reflecting on everything. And then one army division, the Deutschland troop, went out and marched down Fliegenstrasse. Finally, Hitler stood up and declared, "It has begun. The ball is now rolling. Even I can't stop it now. God willing, it will have a good outcome." Then he left the room and went down the stairs to the library, and he closed the door. No one could go in. Only the next morning. Then he rang for me. He had not even told me if or when he wanted to be woken up. So I had to just wait, watch the bell, and be ready. And then I went in. I personally understood it this way, that it was the Wehrmacht that really wanted to go into Poland, and not him. So you mean to say that it was the general staff that really wanted to attack Poland and not him? The generals wanted it. But he was for it too. Yes, sure. But it's like this. You have 100 men under you, and you're the boss. And when they don't want to go along with you, what do you do? either you go along with them, or the company falls apart and goes broke. That's really the way you have to look at it to understand it. Maybe I'm a bit too old for it all now to understand everything that happened, especially when, in the last 50 years or so, I've not really given any thought to any of these things. I only remember how Herr von Ribbentrop said to the Englishman, "Come to your senses, man." Now, I can't recall the exact words which followed, but he said, basically, "There is no reason to start a war regarding Poland." And then suddenly, Mr. Eden ran down the stairs, and I remember how he said, "If I had stayed up there another 15 minutes with them, I probably would have been in agreement with them, the Germans, and that's just not permitted." Hitler wanted, especially, to be on good terms with England, and if possible, also with the French. He always said that the Germans and the French had the very best soldiers, but that no one could control colonies like England did. He really said that, and they can, with just one hand, control millions of people. We can't. We don't have the people for that. They, the English, know how to do that. And afterwards he said, the best soldiers will have to go with the worst soldiers. And he meant, of course, the Italians. And he said, at one time they had the Romans, but they don't have any Romans now. We did an inspection tour on the front lines in Poland, and that's when he and I got into an argument over a bottle of his favorite mineral water. It wasn't there, and I was blamed for it, although it really was not my fault, but rather the whole crew. In every car, there were bottles of this mineral water. When they sat down to lunch, he wanted a bottle of the mineral water, and there was none there. I went to the doctor and I said, "Look, we're all drinking from this spring water." He checked it out and he said, "Yes, so what?" And I said, "Well, the boss claims that I forgot his water, and I wanted to, well..." But then the others suddenly began to claim that I had tried to poison the boss, and all such nonsense. I was sent to Berlin. I was dismissed. But I think he was just looking for someone to let his frustration out on. And whenever that occurred, it was usually me that was the lightning rod. And the real reason for his anger was this. From his personal SS guard unit, I had assembled a small troop of 25 men to arrive there in advance. And they got ambushed. And they were all killed. They were found lying in a fruit grove. Their bodies were mutilated, their genitals cut out, their tongues cut out, and their eyes gouged out. He was furious, and that happened right there on that very same day. And of course he was furious, and I wore it. I was sent to Berlin, and for 3 months I really didn't do anything there. I was supposed to go to Tannenberg, Hitler's quarters in the Black Forest. The superintendent of the chancellery came to see me, and he said, "Well," he said this and that, and he saw to it that I had everything that I needed. But he thought that I should continue to work there with Hitler. I said, "No, I have already served the Führer, I want to go back to my troop." "Nope," he said, "I can't help you with that." And so I continued to wait, and it was about a quarter of a year by then. I continued to receive my salary, but I had nothing to do. And then one fine day, as the Führer once again returned to Berlin, I waited for him. I knew at what time he would usually go to bed, and so I went in, went upstairs, and I waited for him by the door. He looked at me and he blurted out, "What's the matter?" in sort of a half-angry tone. "What is it?" I said, "My Führer, I'm stuck now here in Berlin. I want to report back to my troop." He left me standing there, and he went into his room. Then he opened the door again and said, "To which troop do you want to go? To my SS Guard unit? You really can't do any better than that." I said, "My Führer, I come from the Navy, and I want to return to the Navy." He said, "All right then, tell Herr Puttkamer to come upstairs." Herr Puttkamer came up and went inside. Then he returned and said, "The Führer has decided that you are now free to return to the Navy, and that I should ensure that you receive an appropriate posting." He asked, "Where do you want to go?" I said, "Well, to the U-boat service, of course." That was the big thing those days, the U-boats. And so then I departed for Kiel. Within 3 days, I had my orders, and I was to report for the U-boat service. But when I got there, I was told, "Sorry, but for that you need special training," as it was really very technical. "And all of that takes time to learn, you know? So we'll send you on a destroyer instead." I thought to myself, this guy's a real smooth talker. And then he said, "I know you, and I know what you really want and why. When you return, you want to have a big story to tell to the Führer about us here in the Navy." So then, off I went from Kiel to Wilhelmshaven, which we in the Navy call Schlichtau, and I reported for duty. But they didn't even want to take me. However, I had this letter in my hand from the Führer, and I showed it to them. And so they grabbed my suitcase, and in I went. And then suddenly, I was a somebody again. Until then, I was a nobody, and they didn't even want to take me on their ship. But they had to allow me. And so we sailed for Narvik. I was actually sunk 3 times while in the Navy. Later, when I returned to Berlin, Hitler greeted me again, and he said, "I had to bring you back. You were on 3 ships, and all 3 went to the bottom. And if I allowed you to continue, our Navy would soon run out of ships." Of course, he was joking. But he said that. All of the ships that you get on seem to go to the bottom. Don't believe for a minute that he was told everything that was going on, not even during the war. I can tell you of one episode of a situation briefing at the Wolf's Lair. All of the generals were there for a meeting, and then they stepped outside. I glanced at my watch, and then I realized, oh my, it's almost time to eat lunch. So I quickly went to the kitchen to see how lunch was coming along, and everything seemed good. Then, when I came back out, I realized that all of the generals were standing outside talking. Now, there was sort of a barracks on the one side, then the hall, and on the other side, there were various rooms. The situation room was near the front. As the generals were standing outside, I overheard them say, "He can tell us whatever he wants, but we'll just do what we think is right." The boss actually couldn't trust any of them. And he didn't. Herr Goebbels, perhaps. And otherwise, Herr Keitel. He was his master's servant and nothing else. The best was Jodl. He was a brilliant strategist. To this day, I believe that they would have respected Adolf Hitler far more if he had been of a higher rank and had not just been a corporal in the First World War. Through the various conversations that I was privy to, it had become apparent that the Russians had plans to attack us, and that this was really not too far off. An attack seemed imminent, and so our general said, "We will have to attack them first." Hitler wanted the best for the German people, but he wasn't able to achieve it. And that frustrated him, if you know what I mean. It really tormented him inside, and that, more than anything else, is what led to his eventual demise.
Hitler, you knew him. What was he like? I have been asked that question 1,000 times since 1945, and nothing is more difficult to answer. Approximately 200,000 books have dealt with the Second World War and with its central figure Adolf Hitler. But has the real Hitler been discovered by any of them? The enigma of Hitler is beyond all human comprehension. The left-wing German weekly Die Zeit once put it. Salvador Dali, art's unique genius, sought to penetrate the mystery in one of his most intensely dramatic paintings. Towering mountain landscapes all but fill the canvas, leaving only a few luminous meters of seashore dotted with delicately miniaturized human figures. The last witness to a dying piece. A huge telephone receiver, dripping tears of blood, hangs from the branch of a dead tree. And here there hang umbrellas and bats whose portent is visibly the same. As Dali tells it, Chamberlain's umbrella appeared in this painting in a sinister light, made evident by the bat, and it struck me when I painted it as a thing of enormous anguish. He then confided, I felt this painting to be deeply prophetic, but I confess that I haven't yet figured out the Hitler enigma either. He attracted me only as an object of my mad imaginings and because I saw him as a man uniquely capable of turning things completely upside down. What a lesson in humility for the braying critics who have rushed into print since 1945 with their thousands of definitive books, most of them scornful, about this man who so troubled the introspective Dali that 40 years later he still felt anguished and uncertain in the presence of his own hallucinatory painting. Apart from Dali, who else has ever tried to present an objective portrayal of this extraordinary man who Dali labeled the most explosive figure in human history? The mountains of Hitler books based on blind hatred and ignorance do little to describe or explain the most powerful man the world has ever seen. How, I ponder, do these thousands of disparate portraits of Hitler in any way resemble the man that I knew? The Hitler seated beside me, standing up, talking, listening. It has become impossible to explain to people, fed fantastic tales for decades, that what they have read or heard on television just does not correspond to the truth. People have come to accept fiction, repeated 1,000 times over, as reality. Yet they have never seen Hitler, never spoken to him, never heard a word from his mouth. The very name of Hitler immediately conjures up a grimacing devil, the fount of all one's negative emotions. Like Pavlov's bell, the mention of Hitler is meant to dispense with substance and reality. In time, however, history will demand more than these summary judgments. Hitler is always present before my eyes. As a man of peace in 1936, as a man of war in 1944, it is not possible to have been a personal witness to the life of such an extraordinary man without being marked by it forever. Not a day goes by, but Hitler rises again in my memory, not as a man long dead, but as a real being who paces his office floor, seats himself in his chair, pokes the burning logs in the fireplace. The first thing anyone noticed when he came into view was a small mustache. Countless times he had been advised to shave it off, but he would always refuse. People were used to him the way that he was. He was not tall, no more than was Napoleon or Alexander the Great. Hitler had deep blue eyes that many found bewitching, although I did not find them so. Nor did I detect the electric current his hands were said to give off. I gripped them quite a few times and was never struck by his lightning. His face showed emotion or indifference according to the passion or apathy of the moment. At times, he was as though benumbed, saying not a word, while his jaws moved in the meanwhile as if they were grinding an obstacle to smithereens in the void. Then he would come suddenly alive and launch into a speech directed at you alone, as though he were addressing a crowd of hundreds of thousands at Berlin's Tempelhof airfield. Then he became as if transfigured, even if his complexion, otherwise dull, lit up as he spoke. And at such times, to be sure, Hitler was strangely attractive and as if possessed of magic powers. Anything that might have seemed too solemn in his remarks, he quickly tempered with a touch of humor. The picturesque world, the biting phrase were at his command. In a flash, he would paint a word picture that brought a smile, or come up with an unexpected and disarming comparison. He could be harsh and even implacable in his judgments, and yet almost at the same time be surprisingly conciliatory, sensitive, and warm. After 1945, Hitler was accused of every cruelty, but it was not in his nature to be cruel. He loved children. It was an entirely natural thing for him to stop his car and share his food with young cyclists along the road. Once he gave his raincoat to a derelict plodding in the rain. At midnight, he would interrupt his work and prepare the food for his dog Blondie. He could not bear to eat meat because it meant the death of a living creature. He refused to have so much as a rabbit or trout sacrificed to provide his food. He would allow only eggs on his table because egg laying meant that the hen had been spared rather than killed. Hitler's eating habits were a constant source of amazement to me. How could someone on such a rigorous schedule, who had taken part in tens of thousands of exhausting mass meetings from which he emerged bathed with sweat, often losing 2 to 4 pounds in the process, who slept only 3 to 4 hours a night, and who, from 1940 to 1945, carried the whole world on his shoulders while ruling over 380 million Europeans, how, I wondered, could he physically survive on just a boiled egg, a few tomatoes, 2 or 3 pancakes, and a plate of noodles? But he actually gained weight. He drank only water. He did not smoke and would not tolerate smoking in his presence. At 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, he would still be talking, untroubled, close to his fireplace, lively, often amusing. He never showed any sign of weariness. Dead tired his audience might be, but not Hitler. He was depicted as a tired old man. Nothing was further from the truth. In September 1944, when he was reported to be fairly doddering, I spent a week with him. His mental and physical vigor were still exceptional. The attempt made on his life on July 20th had, if anything, recharged him. He took tea in his quarters as tranquilly as if we had been in a small private apartment at the Chancellery before the war, or enjoying the view of snow and bright blue sky through his great bay window at Berchtesgaden. At the very end of his life, to be sure, his back had become bent, but his mind remained as clear as a flash of lightning. The testament he dictated with extraordinary composure on the eve of his death, at 3 in the morning of April 29th, 1945, provides us a lasting testimony. Napoleon, at Fontainebleau, was not without his moments of panic before his abdication. Hitler simply shook hands with his associates in silence, breakfasted as on any other day, then went to his death as if he were going on a stroll. When has history ever witnessed so enormous a tragedy brought to its end with such iron self-control? Hitler's most notable characteristic was ever his simplicity. The most complex of problems resolved itself in his mind into a few basic principles. His actions were geared to ideas and decisions that could be understood by anyone. The laborer from Essen, the isolated farmer, the rural industrialist, and the university professor could all easily follow his line of thought. The very clarity of his reasoning made everything obvious. His behavior and his lifestyle never changed, even when he became the ruler of Germany. He dressed and lived frugally. During his early days in Munich, he spent no more than a mark per day for food. At no stage in his life did he spend anything on himself. Throughout his 13 years in the chancellor, he never carried a wallet or ever had money of his own. Hitler was self-taught and made no attempt to hide the fact. The smug conceit of intellectuals, their shiny ideas packaged like so many flashlight batteries, irritated him at times. His own knowledge he had acquired through selective and unremitting study, and he knew far more than thousands of diploma-decorated academics. I don't think anyone ever read as much as he did. He normally read one book per day, always first reading the conclusion and the index in order to gauge the work's interest for him. He had the power to extract the essence of each book and then store it in his computer-like mind. I have heard him talk about complicated scientific books with faultless precision, even at the height of the war. His intellectual curiosity was limitless. He was readily familiar with the writings of the most diverse authors, and nothing was too complex for his comprehension. He had a deep knowledge and understanding of Buddha, Confucius, and Jesus Christ, as well as Luther, Calvin, and Savonarola, of literary giants such as Dante, Schiller, Shakespeare, and Goethe, and analytical writers such as Renan, Gobineau, Chamberlain, and Sorel. He had trained himself in philosophy by studying Aristotle and Plato. He could quote entire paragraphs of Schopenhauer from memory, and for a long time carried a pocket edition of Schopenhauer with him. Nietzsche taught him much about the willpower. His thirst for knowledge was unquenchable. He spent hundreds of hours studying the works of Tacitus and Mommsen, military strategists such as Clausewitz, and empire builders such as Bismarck. Nothing escaped him. World history or the history of civilizations, the study of the Bible and the Talmud, Thomistic philosophy and all the masterpieces of Homer, Sophocles, Horace, Ovid, Titus Livius, Cicero. He knew Julian the Apostate as if he had been his contemporary. His knowledge also extended to mechanics. He knew how engines worked. He understood the ballistics of various weapons, and he astonished the best medical scientist with his knowledge of medicine and biology. The universality of Hitler's knowledge may surprise or displease those unaware of it, but it is nonetheless a historical fact. Hitler was one of the most cultivated men of the century, many times more so than Churchill, an intellectual mediocrity, or more than Pierre Laval. With him, mere cursory knowledge of history, more than Roosevelt or Eisenhower. His earliest years, Hitler was different than other children. He had an inner strength and was guided by his spirit and his instincts. He could draw skillfully when he was only 11 years old. His sketches made at that age show a remarkable firmness and liveliness. His first paintings in watercolors, created at age 15, are full of poetry and sensitivity. One of the most striking early works, Fortress Utopia, also shows him to have been an artist of rare imagination. His artistic orientation took on many forms. He wrote poetry from the time he was a lad. He dictated a complete play to his sister Paula, who was amazed at his presumption. At the age of 16 in Vienna, he launched into the creation of an opera. He even designed the stage settings, as well as all the costumes. And, of course, the characters were Wagnerian heroes. More than just an artist, Hitler was above all an architect. Hundreds of his works were notable, as much for the architecture as for the painting. From memory alone, he could reproduce in every detail the onion dome of a church or the intricate curves of wrought iron. Indeed, it was to fulfill his dream of becoming an architect that Hitler went to Vienna at the beginning of the century. When one sees the hundreds of paintings, sketches, and drawings he created at the time, which reveal his mastery of three-dimensional figures, it is astounding that his examiners at the Fine Arts Academy failed him in two successive examinations. German historian Werner Maser, no friend of Hitler, castigated these examiners. All of these works revealed extraordinary architectural gifts and knowledge. The builder of the Third Reich gives the former Fine Arts Academy of Vienna cause for shame. In his room, Hitler always displayed an old photograph of his mother. The memory of the mother he loved was with him until the day he died. Before leaving this earth, on April 30th, 1945, he placed his mother's photograph in front of him. She had blue eyes like his and a similar face. Her maternal intuition told her that her son was different from other children. She acted almost as if she knew her son's destiny. When she died, she felt anguished by the immense mystery surrounding her son. Throughout the years of his youth, Hitler lived the life of a virtual recluse. His greatest wish was to withdraw from the world. At heart a loner, he wandered about, ate meager meals, but devoured the books of three public libraries. He abstained from conversations and had few friends. It is almost impossible to imagine another such destiny, where a man started with so little and reached such heights. Alexander the Great was the son of a king. Napoleon, from a well-to-do family, was a general at age 24. 15 years after Vienna, Hitler would still be an unknown corporal. Thousands of others had a thousand times more opportunity to leave their mark on the world. Hitler was not much concerned with his private life. In Vienna, he had lived in shabby, crampy lodgings. But for all that, he rented a piano that took up half his room and concentrated on composing his opera. He lived on bread, milk, and vegetable soup. His poverty was real. He did not even own an overcoat. He shoveled streets on snowy days. He carried luggage at the railway station. He spent many weeks in shelters for the homeless. But he never stopped painting or reading. Despite his dire poverty, Hitler somehow managed to maintain a clean appearance. Landlords and landladies in Vienna and Munich all remembered him for his civility and pleasant disposition. His behavior was impeccable. His room was always spotless, his meager belongings meticulously arranged, and his clothes neatly hung or folded. He washed and ironed his own clothes, something which in those days few men did. He needed almost nothing to survive, and money from the sale of a few paintings was sufficient to provide for all his needs. Impressed by the beauty of the church and a Benedictine monastery where he was part of the choir and had served as an altar boy, Hitler dreamt fleetingly of becoming a Benedictine monk. And it was at that time, too, interestingly enough, that whenever he attended Mass, he always had to pass beneath the first swastika he had ever seen. It was graven in the stone escutcheon of the abbey portal. Hitler's father, a customs officer, hoped the boy would follow in his own footsteps and become a civil servant. His tutor encouraged him to become a monk. Instead, the young Hitler went, or rather fled, to Vienna. And there, thwarted in his artistic aspirations by the bureaucratic mediocrities of academia, he turned to isolation and meditation. Lost in the great capital of Austria-Hungary, he searched for his destiny. During the first 30 years of Hitler's life, the date of April 20th, 1889 meant nothing to anyone. He was born on that day in Brunau, a small town in the Inn Valley. During his exile in Vienna, he often thought of his modest home, and particularly of his mother. When she fell ill, he returned home from Vienna to look after her. For weeks he nursed her, did all the household chores, and supported her as the most loving of sons. When she finally died on Christmas Eve, his pain was immense. Racked with grief, he buried his mother in the little country cemetery. "I have never seen anyone so prostrate with grief," said the mother's doctor, who happened to be Jewish. Hitler had not yet focused on politics, but without his rightly knowing, that was the career to which he was most strongly called. Politics would ultimately blend with his passion for art. People, the masses, will be the clay the sculptor shapes into an immortal form. The human clay would become for him the beautiful work like one of Myron's marble sculptures, a Hans Marquardt painting, or Wagner's Ring Trilogy. His love of music, art, and architecture had not removed him from the political life and social concerns of Vienna. In order to survive, he worked as a common laborer side by side with other workers. He was a silent spectator, but nothing escaped him. Not the vanity and egoism of the bourgeoisie, not the moral and material misery of the people, nor yet the hundreds of thousands of workers who surged down the wide avenues of Vienna with anger in their hearts. He'd also been taken aback by the growing presence in Vienna of bearded Jews wearing kaftans, a sight unknown in Linz. "How can they be Germans?" he asked himself. He read the statistics. In 1860, there were 69 Jewish families in Vienna. 40 years later, there were 200,000. They were everywhere. He observed their invasion of the universities and the legal and medical professions, and their takeover of the newspapers. Hitler was exposed to the passionate reactions of the workers to this influx, but the workers were not alone in their unhappiness. There were many prominent persons in Austria and Hungary who did not hide their resentment at what they believed was an alien invasion of their country. The mayor of Vienna, a Christian Democrat and a powerful orator, was eagerly listened to by Hitler. Hitler was also concerned with the fate of the 8 million Austrian Germans kept apart from Germany and thus deprived of their rightful German nationhood. He saw Emperor Franz Joseph as a bitter and petty old man, unable to cope with the problems of the day and the aspirations of the future. Quietly, the young Hitler was summing things up in his mind. First, Austrians were part of Germany, the common fatherland. Second, the Jews were aliens within the German community. Third, patriotism was only valid if it was shared by all classes. The common people with whom Hitler had shared grief and humiliation were just as much a part of the fatherland as the millionaires of high society. Fourth, class war would sooner or later condemn both workers and bosses to ruin in any country. No country could survive class war. Only cooperation between workers and bosses can benefit the country. Workers must be respected and live with decency and honor. Creativity must never be stifled. When Hitler later said that he had formed a social and political doctrine in Vienna, he told the truth. 10 years later, his observations made in Vienna would become the order of the day. Thus, Hitler was to live for several years in the crowded city of Vienna as a virtual outcast, yet quietly observing everything around him. His strength came from within. He did not rely on anyone to do his thinking for him. Exceptional human beings always feel lonely amid the vast human throng. Hitler saw his solitude as a wonderful opportunity to meditate and not to be submerged in a mindless sea. In order not to be lost in the waste of a sterile desert, a strong soul seeks refuge within himself. Hitler was such a soul. The lightning in Hitler's life would come from the word. All his artistic talent would be channeled into his mastery of communication and eloquence. Hitler would never conceive of popular conquests without the power of the word. He would enchant and be enchanted by it. He would find total fulfillment when the magic of his words inspired the hearts and minds of the masses with whom he communed. He would feel reborn each time he conveyed with mystical beauty the knowledge he had acquired in his lifetime. Hitler's incantatory eloquence will remain, for a very long time, a vast field of study for the psychoanalyst. The power of Hitler's word is the key. Without it, there never would have been a Hitler era. Did Hitler believe in God? He believed deeply in God. He called God the Almighty, master of all that is known and unknown. Propagandists portrayed Hitler as an atheist. He was not. He had contempt for hypocritical and materialistic clerics, but he was not alone in that. He believed in the necessity of standards and theological dogmas, without which, he repeatedly said, the great institution of the Christian Church would collapse. These dogmas clashed with his intelligence, but he also recognized that it was hard for the human mind to encompass all the problems of creation, its limitless scope, its breathtaking beauty. He acknowledged that every human being has spiritual needs. The song of the nightingale, the pattern and color of a flower, continually brought him back to the great problems of creation. No one in the world has spoken to me so eloquently about the existence of God. He held this view not because he was brought up as a Christian, but because his analytical mind bound him to the concept of God. Hitler's faith transcended formulas and contingencies. God was for him the basis of everything, the ordainer of all things, of his destiny, and that of all others. Leon Degrelle's recollections of Adolf Hitler are those of a man who fought and died for his nation and for the advancement of his race. If there are many different ways to conceptualize and reflect on the enigma that was Hitler, one is certainly, as Degrelle has done, to juxtapose Hitler to other great men in the history of European civilization, and to see him through our own eyes and not through the prism fashioned for us by our enemies. There is an eye within the eye, which also has sight, however, and this deeper lens on the world permits those of us who see the grandiosity of Hitler and his life, not measured in terms of an outcome of a war the world had waged on him, but in the immensity of his heart and in his dreams.
Hunderttausenden von euch, die ihr jetzt zuhört in ganz Deutschland, dass in Hunderttausenden von euch in diesem vergangenen Jahr manches Mal die Frage lebendig wurde, wie lange denn noch? Ich weiß es, meine Kameraden, es ist euch wohl oft schwer gefallen, wenn ihr meint, es müsse und nun ein Wandel kommen. Herausgewachsen. Bin einst selbst unter euch gestanden. Bin in 4,5 Jahren Krieg wieder mitten unter euch gewesen. Und ich spreche damit nur zu denen ich einst selbst gehört habe, mit denen ich mich auch heute noch verbunden fühle. Und für die ich letzten Endes ja auch kämpfe. Ich habe mich dann durch Fleiß, durch Lernen und ich kann sagen, im innersten Wesen bin ich immer das geblieben, was ich vorher war. Mich interessiert nur das deutsche Volk ganz allein, denn gehöre ich. Und für dieses deutsche Volk in seiner Gesamtheit setze ich mich ein. Sie wollen sehen, dass das, was ich jetzt lehre, nicht ich trage. Ein ganzer Mensch, sondern das ganze Volk wie ein Mann. Mann und Mann und Leib dahinter stehen.
Ihr müsst heute vor die Welt treten. Mit mir und hinter mir. So müsst ihr feiern, Herr Lehrer. Wir wollen nichts anderes als Friede. Wollen nichts anderes als Ruhe. Wollen nichts anderes, als uns unseren Aufgaben bieten können. Wollen aber auch nichts anderes, als unser gleiches Recht. Und lassen uns nicht unsere Ehre von irgendjemandem wegnehmen. Wir können nicht versprechen, dass diese Wiederauferstehung unseres Volkes von selbst kommt. Wir wollen arbeiten, aber das Volk selbst, es muss mithelfen. Es soll nie glauben, dass ihm plötzlich Freiheit, Glück und Leben vom Himmel geschenkt wird. Alles wurzelt nur im eigenen Willen, in der eigenen Arbeit. Wenn wir sagen, nicht den Reichen, gebt ihr den Armen, sondern wir sagen, deutsches Volk, hilft ihr selbst. Jeder soll helfen, ob arm oder reich. Jeder soll sich denken, es gibt nur einen, der ärmer ist als ich, und gebt ihr ihn selbst. Wir sind doch jetzt wieder ein so fleißiges und tatkräftiges Volk geworden. Was schaffen wir jetzt nicht wieder in Deutschland? Was haben wir nicht für Aufgaben? Man hat uns die ganzen Jahre schon eingeredet, dass der Deutsche sowieso nicht ganz gleichmütig sei den anderen Völkern in der Welt. Was haben wir heute für Aufgaben? Was für gewaltige Werke bauen wir? Wir bauen heute die schönsten Straßen, gewaltige Anlagen, industrielle Art, neue Erfindungen haben wir gemacht. Ungeheure Wohnhauskolonien, die werden entstehen und sind bereits entstanden. Was wird nicht überall gearbeitet auf allen Gebieten? Wir haben bewiesen in diesen 3 Jahren, dass wir ein Volk sind, das bestehen kann vor den anderen. Und darum bitte ich nun, deutsches Volk, darüber gib nun ein Urteil ab. Der Welt unterstelle ich mich nicht. Ich kann mich nicht richten. Dir unterwerfe mich. Richte du mich. Ich
tue
ein
Bekenntnis ab, ob du... Meine Arbeit für richtig hältst. Ob du glaubst, dass ich fleißig gewesen bin, dass ich gearbeitet habe, dass ich mich in diesem Jahr für dich eingesetzt habe, dass ich anständig meine Zeit verwendet habe im Dienste meines Volkes. Gib du jetzt eine Stimme ab. Wenn ja, dann tritt für mich ein, so wie ich für dich eingesetzt habe.
Einer wollte den anderen nicht verstehen. Jeder dachte nur an sich, fünftens noch seine Klasse. Und wir selbst sind nun die Zeugen der Folgen. Diese Verwirrung versteckt es gewesen. Ihr müsst in eurer Jugend euch bewahren. Was ihr besitzt, das große Gefühl, der Kameradschaft und der Zusammengehörigkeit. Wenn ihr das nicht preisgeben werdet, wird keine Welt in euch stehen und nehmen verwöhnen. Und ihr seid dann einmal als Volk genau zum Weltgefühl, wie ihr es jetzt seid als deutsche Jugend, als unsere ganze Hoffnung. Unser Volk ist zuversichtlich. Und unser Glaube, denn ihr, meine Jungen, ihr seid die lebenden Garanten. Ihr seid das lebende Deutschland der Zukunft. Nicht eine leere Idee, nicht ein leerer
Formalismus, ein blasses Schämen. Nein, ihr seid Blut von uns, Fleisch von uns, Geist von uns. Ihr seid unseres Volkes Weiterleben.
Wahr, die große Not unseres Volkes, die uns einst ergriffen hat und die uns zusammenführte, im Kampfe bringen und prosern ließ. Daher können das alle die nicht verstehen, die nicht die gleiche Not in ihrem Volk gelitten haben. Yes.